Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee to order and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean.
I am here.
Representative Hertaus.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Lomer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Newberger. Representative O'Neill. Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Rosenthal. Representative Schoen. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Winkler. And Representative Zerwas.
Here. Okay, members, the first order of business is approval of the minutes for March 19th. Anybody want to offer the minutes?
So moved.
All right. Representative Considine moves the minutes for March 19th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, Representative Nash, you have House File 1718 up. Chair will move House File 1718 to pass and refer to the General Register. Representative Nash, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Given the late night, I'll be very brief. My bill is even more brief, and thank you, Representative Hillstrom, for co-signing. House File 1718 is a repeal bill of the 2010 Compact for Juveniles and is being replaced by the 2014 Compact. And I do have a testifier, and I will turn it over to her.
Go ahead, ma'am, with your name and title and begin.
Roseanne Bish, Deputy Compact Administrator. Thank you, Chairman Cornish. The ICJ is a mechanism in which we transfer juveniles to other states that we get supervision for them, and then juveniles that transfer into the state of Minnesota, we get supervision for them through this compact. It also allows us to return juveniles that have run away, escaped, or absconded, and in doing so have crossed state lines. In 2010, Minnesota passed Statute 260.515, which is often referred to as the new juvenile compact. At that time, a decision was made not to repeal the old compact, as it would allow us to continue to do business with the states that had not yet passed the new compact. In July 1st, 2014, Georgia, the last state, passed the compact. Therefore, statutes 260.51 and 260.53 are no longer necessary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, members, any questions? Seeing none, Representative Nash, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, short bill, short words. Thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do juveniles have the right to fight extradition?
I'll go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Juveniles don't have extradition under the compact. There's different processes to return them. If they've run away, we do what's called a Form 3. Otherwise, if they don't agree to return, there is a process that's not formally extradition, but there is a process that we go through the courts, and this compact governs that process.
Thank you.
Any public testimony? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion for House File 1718 passed, referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Members, we do have, hopefully we won't need it, but we do have the room reserved tonight at 5 o'clock in the basement hearing room if we need the time. And now, Representative Sanders. Representative Sanders has an elections bill here. The chair's preference would be to focus on sections 8 and 24. Those are the two sections under our purview, and would also be my preference, and all this is GOP members only, is to stick with the author on amendments if we could, either for or against. The Representative Sanders, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's correct. Section 8, and I do have some individuals from the County Attorneys Association. They've this language in Section 8 is from a bill that Representative O'Driscoll's had, and is an issue that he's been working on for a couple years. But it allows the prosecutor's discretion, and also kicks the investigatory part of the investigation to an actual, or allows the county attorney to actually kick that to an actual investigatory. Somebody that actually investigates things, like law enforcement. Investigators, thank you. So that is something that I believe in it. Like I said, that there are some folks here from the county attorneys that can talk to that. But that's been, from my understanding, pretty agreed to language. And then Section 24. This permits an errors and omissions judicial proceeding. If the candidate has filed for an office and the candidate is not eligible to hold office, If the complainant is successful, the candidate could be replaced on the ballot with another candidate using existing procedures for filed vacancy and nomination. Is that the correct section? So I do have someone here from the Secretary of State's office, like I said, as well as some from the County Attorney's office, if there are any questions. Other than that, we ask for your support. This is the Omnibus Elections Bill, non-controversial, flew through government operations and elections, and looking to keep it non-controversial and hope to have unanimous support.
And Representative Sanders, I forgot to move your bill, House File 840. I'll move it and to pass and refer to state government finance members' questions. Okay. Mr. Representative Quam, do you want to offer any amendments?
I was waiting for the amendments. Yes, I'd like to offer Amendment A15-0313, and basically the courts have affirmed that we have to enforce the parity when we have judge of affiliation, but there is no way to verify that because it's not accessible data. And the amendment is basically aimed at allowing the courts to actually be able to address the issue. Now, I know that this section is not in the purview of this committee, so it shall be, I'll revisit it on the floor, but basically, if we have a statute, we can't access the data in the courts to verify, then there's a problem with our codes, and you know, frankly, this committee ought to be concerned that we're not allowing accessibility of data to actually enforce the law. So I will withdraw that amendment.
Representative Quam withdraws his A15-0313 amendment. Go ahead, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I'm offering Amendment A15-312. And it is provisional ballots, which over 97% of the people that live in the United States have this protection of the integrity of the electoral system. Over 97%. Minnesota is an outlier in that we don't have this protection for the integrity of our electoral system. And since it's not one of those two sections, it will be revisited on the floor because, frankly, the integrity of our electoral system is not something I take lightly. And the fact that, again, over 97% of the people living in the U.S. have this protection on the integrity of the electoral system, I think it would be reasonable that Minnesota look at that, but again, I'll withdraw that one because it isn't in the purview of this committee. And then, Mr. Chair, I do have a third amendment.
Representative Quam withdraws the A15-0312 amendment. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to offer the A15-0317 amendment. And frankly, it's to maintain in section on page 6 in section 8 the language in regards to the county attorney. New language put in there is any public employee, because the county attorney holds an office. I'm not sure that really covered, but frankly, here's my issue. Having before I was in the legislature, conversed with a Secretary of State while they're in that office. They couldn't go into any details, but there were dozens of cases of election fraud forwarded to the county attorneys, and nothing was done with that. More recently, which became public, is that there were hundreds and hundreds of illegal votes cast. And only because it became public did the county attorneys actually address it, and there were several hundred convictions. And I have concerns that if we take out this language, that there will be less incentive for the county attorneys to actually guarantee the integrity of our electoral system by enforcing and pursuing the violations, which I think they're soft on to begin with.
Representative Quam, you're offering that amendment then?
Correct.
Representative Sanders or your testifier?
First I'll say, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I didn't know these amendments were coming until I saw the list. So I'm going to oppose the all three amendments. I know two of them were withdrawn. This amendment here is a bill that was fully vetted in the Government Operations and Elections Committee, something that's language that Representative O'Driscoll's been working on for even last session, working on. It's a big improvement, a big step forward, in our opinion, from the way things currently work. But I would let Mr. Schweigert talk a little more in depth about the specifics of this section.
Okay, sir, would you state your name and title and begin?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Ben Schweigert. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I am here today representing my office and also the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Mr. Chair and members, county attorneys around the state take cases of illegal voting for registries. Every year, county attorneys around the state investigate and prosecute these cases. Now, this provision that we are looking at today is anomalous in our code, in the sense that it takes away significant parts of the county attorney's prosecutorial discretion. In general, in a criminal case, it's committed to the discretion of the prosecutor to determine whether it's in the public interest to charge a case and to determine whether it's possible to prevail in a case were it charged, which of course is an important consideration in determining whether to move forward. This is a provision of statute that the County Attorneys Association has had concerns about for some time. And it's also a provision, the constitutionality of which has been called into question, most recently to my knowledge, by a court in the 4th Judicial District. So we support the change that is included in Representative Sanders' bill and oppose the amendment for the reason that it would bring the manner in which county attorneys are to proceed in these cases into line with the generally applicable standards regarding the prosecutorial functions and duties of a county attorney. In other words, to treat these cases according to those standards which we apply in the rest of our criminal practice. We believe that that's appropriate here as well.
Representatives Considine, Dean, and Hillston. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, Representative Quam just mentioned hundreds of convictions for voter fraud. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Go ahead, sir. Could you state your name again? I'm sorry.
Yes, Representative, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Schweiger.
Okay.
I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. Mr. Chair and members, there are not hundreds of cases of voter fraud prosecuted. There are cases of illegal voting. Those are cases generally where someone is confused about their voting rights status and votes, or someone who is ineligible to vote for some other reason votes and is prosecuted for that. So those cases do arise. However, those would be different than what would generally be classified as voter fraud, where someone would claim to be someone that they're not or something like that.
Okay, Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give me a ballpark number on what we're talking for those?
Mr. Schweiger.
Mr. Chair, members, I am not in possession of that information right now, unfortunately. So.
Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, or maybe Representative Sanders, you might be able to answer this. Do you know how many cases were actually charged and actually convicted throughout the state in, say, 2014 and maybe 2012 elections?
Mr. Schweiger.
Mr. Chair and members, I am not aware. But there, I would guess that it would be in the scores. But I don't have an exact number.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I just want to challenge a little bit some of your statements. You talked about how you think that county attorneys aren't already prosecuting these cases and that there's all these allegations that they're not investigating. I want to show you on page 6 of the bill. So if you go to page 6 and you look at section 8, mm-hmm. that's where current law is. And under current law, if the county attorney does not prosecute, it's a misdemeanor, and they forfeit their office, these cases. So the idea that there are county attorneys across the state that are willfully not doing their job just isn't the case, as you've not seen a single one of the county attorneys charged with a misdemeanor or removed from office for failing to do this kind of work. So, members, in many places, they either charge by complaint or, as the statute as it's currently written says, take it to a grand jury. And in many instances, when it's taken to a grand jury, the grand jury doesn't indict. And one of the reasons is because you actually have to prove that somebody cast the ballot, right? You actually have to prove that somebody went to the polling place, they checked in, they grabbed the ballot, they checked it off, and they submitted it. Because unless you actually cast the ballot, you didn't commit it. You didn't commit voter fraud. And so if you have concerns about, you know, voter fraud and people casting ballots that they shouldn't, I'm not really sure that looking at the county attorneys and their role of charging or not charging or whether law enforcement investigates or the county attorney investigates is really where your issue is. I don't see any issue with the county attorney's language here. I actually believe that if you have law enforcement investigate and they submit the case for consideration of charging, you have a lot more of an open process, right? Police reports become public. Once a case is closed, if there's not criminal charges, that's all public. You have a lot more public documentation that you can request. So I think the county attorney language is better.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I see the representative from the County Attorneys Association in the room. Would they be willing to come down and answer, or he would come down and answer a couple questions?
Who would that be? There he is. Sir, you want to come forward and state your name and organization and begin.
Mr. Franklin probably shouldn't go too far either.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robert Small.
Go ahead.
That was Tim Matthew from my office. I was trying to get the information to answer the question. I apologize.
Mr. Chair and sir, we've had the assertion, and I want to make sure. Who's in charge of investigating these cases in the first place? Because is it my understanding, would it be correct, that it's the local sheriff that is in charge of election fraud investigations in any county? Is that correct? Do you know that, for starters? That's probably a question for Mr. Franklin, but I'll go with you. How many cases in the state of Minnesota in the last 10 years were prosecuted, ballpark, by county attorneys in your association for voter fraud around the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Small?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, the answer is I don't have the answer. That's what I was trying to find out when Mr. Schweikert was asked that question. Based on information I heard in other hearings where someone more knowledgeable than I testified, it was but a handful.
So a handful, meaning I'll give less than two hands, because I only have 10 fingers, not hundreds. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, I don't believe it was in the hundreds.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Franklin, if he'd be willing to come down and be put on the spot.
Mr. Franklin, do you want to state your name and title? And I got you on the list there. Okay. Well, you can jump in as soon as Representative Jones does.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Franklin, you represent the Sheriff's Association. Am I correct that it's just the sheriff's responsibility to handle election fraud investigations in each county?
Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schoen, if you can give me time to phone a friend, I can get you more exact details. But in generalities, the way I understand and the way this has normally worked is the county attorney will get some of the complaints. They will give them oftentimes to the investigative body, which is normally the sheriff, to carry out that investigation, report back to the county attorney. Sometimes it's a collaboration between the county attorney and or the sheriff's investigating unit, and then arrive at whatever conclusion there is based upon the investigation.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Franklin, so can you give me an idea of even how many allegations of voter fraud that you might know about in the state of Minnesota as talking to your association members,
Mr. Franklin,
that they deal with on an annual basis or even in the last decade, if you'd like?
Mr. Chairman, I could not quantify a number for you, but I would generally say it varies from county to county. The metropolitan area may have more than the greater Minnesota area for a number of different reasons. Generally speaking, we're not talking about a huge number.
All right. Mr. Chair, I mean, I could keep going around the room. I see Ramsey County is in here, and they do a fine job, but I'm not going to put them on the spot. But, I mean, to make the statement that there's hundreds of prosecutions or otherwise of these cases a year is a little loose and fast. I understand where you're going from, Representative Quam. But, you know, we have a really good system in the state of Minnesota. We have always have one of, regarded as some of the best in the state, especially through our Secretary of State's office, no matter who's held that office. And let's not be too loose with our terminology and attacking our system.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would staff clarify if someone votes illegally, such as the hundreds of felons that were on the voting rolls that were public, were accessed by a group and brought forward and then were investigated and prosecuted. Are they considered fraud under the statute, or is that just illegal voting?
Who's the question for, Representative Quam?
Staff. Whichever is the appropriate staff.
Question, Ms. Pierce?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not that familiar with the voter fraud statutes. I can look it up quick if I can get some time.
Okay, Representative Sanders. Well,
Mr. Chair,
Go ahead.
Because that goes to the crux of the fraud versus illegal. If this doesn't count towards hundreds of illegal people voting in an election, then I'll pull the amendment. But, you know, my interpretation, and obviously since it wasn't obvious enough that the staff knew the answer instantly, I used the word fraud in regards to hundreds of illegal votes cast. Now, if we're dancing on the meaning of is, you know, between fraud and illegal, then, fine. I'm not an expert on, dancing and parsing between those two words.
Okay, seeing no more questions here. Are your questions for members? I don't have anybody on the list any longer. Representative Sanders, any more testimony, or did you want to?
Well, Mr. Chair, I will just say there is a big difference between voter fraud and illegal voting. The Secretary of State's office, if you care, can offer some testimony around that. It's a very complex system, and we strive to increase integrity as much as we can to also increase access and to make sure that as we increase access, that integrity is increased as well. I will say, I mean, this is a provision that over the last couple of years is getting a lot better. We believe that the current language in this House file, which is Representative O'Driscoll's language, is a big step in the right direction. I would ask members to oppose the amendment.
Representative Schoen, before we vote.
Well, I just want to make it clear that might be a little bit more clarification for me. Thank you, Mr. Kwan, because he brought up there was hundreds of convictions. And so that doesn't appear to be the case in the state of Minnesota. We've done a great job. I got to support Representative Sanders here by opposing your amendment. And if not for anything else, this particular area of legislation that we work on, when we come to public safety, we work pretty well bipartisanly on 98% of the issues. And when they go into election, into the elections area, I know Senator Sieben and Representative Sanders have to work together, no matter who's in the majority, to put together a package that this body will support and that the governor would actually sign into law. And he's made it very clear, and I know we talk about this every time that we talk about anything related to elections, that if this is not a bipartisan effort in some way, shape, or form, now we never know for sure how bipartisan that's got to be, right? But we know it's got to be just a little bit, and this is probably a little bit too far. And now we're bipartisanly saying we don't like it, so I got to oppose your amendment even based on that. So.
Okay, Representative Kwan, do you want to... more comments before we vote?
No, I was just preferring the original language that's in statute now, and I guess for clarification, we didn't find out the difference between illegal votes and fraud.
Representative Kwan, I don't know how long we'd have to wait. So
that's fine.
Do you have the answer to that question, ma'am? Otherwise, we don't need any more testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Office and the Minnesota Secretary of State. I see Matt Gearing is here, and he is, I believe, counsel to the Elections Committee and may be able to answer the question specifically. But to your question, I believe the distinction we're talking about and the county attorney's office is probably better equipped to answer this question, too. Voter fraud, when you're talking about someone who... voted with the intent to, for example, impersonate someone or cast a ballot under someone else's name is different, I think, than illegal voting, which is someone who believes they have the right to vote or misunderstands that they're perhaps on paper still for a felony conviction and may register or cast a ballot. And I think that has been the common circumstance where we've seen issues of people voting illegally has been people who believe that they're off paper. But instead, in fact, don't have their rights restored yet. And when I say common, I mean, I think we talked about in 2008, and I apologize, I don't have the numbers with me, but it was something in the 30s of folks that were convicted for voting when they did not have their rights restored yet. And I can talk to what the office does to ensure that we have clean voter rolls and the work we do with the Department of Corrections. And other data sources, but we talked about that in the Elections Committee, and so I don't want to take the committee's time if the committee doesn't want it.
Okay. To the A150317 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion doesn't prevail. To the bill, Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a good bipartisan, nonpartisan elections omnibus bill. I think the two sections before you today were fairly vetted, and I'd ask for member support.
Questions from members? Seeing none, I'll move House File 840 to be passed and go to state government finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Porter, you wish to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I would like to move House File 222 to be recommended to pass and move to the General Register.
Okay, do you have an amendment for your bill? Do you want to?
Yeah, Representative, or Mr. Chair and members, I just a little introduction. Well, let's put the DE1 to get it in the shape, or DE7 to get it in the shape the author would like to. I'd like to move the DE7 amendment.
Can you explain your amendment?
Well, after we move it, you go ahead and move it, and then
I'll move the amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Okay. By explaining the amendment, I'll explain the whole. Now, this, Mr. Chair and members, the House File 222, as amended by DE7, is the license plate reader bill. It's a controversial bill. It's an up, down, and around. We've had, I think, at least two informational hearings and maybe three, and a regular hearing in civil law. Now it's been sent to us. From the start of this license plate reader bill, it was basically a discussion between civil law and public safety, the chairs, and it was my bill, and Representative Scott had some real difficulties with it, and we worked together with the data privacy people and law enforcement in general, and we came to an overall, I hate to use the cliche, peace in the valley, but into an overall agreement to let it out of Representative Scott's committee and on to mine. And with the DE7 amendment, they worked on feverishly over this last weekend with a large group with Representative Scott and the data privacy folks and law enforcement, and came to the result of the DE7 amendment. I'll be up front with the members here. I would like the bill to stay in its present form, and the amendments today that are added on, though well-intentioned and is very within the right to introduce them, I would wish, the chair's wish and the author's wish, to have all the amendments other than DE7 voted down after their introduction. This is I think we finally got the bill to where we want it. We want to naturally going to go into the conference committee if it passes here today onto the floor and into the Senate, and we've got a data retention difference we have to address and some other fine points, but mostly the bills are lined up pretty good, so I think we'll have a good successful outcome in the conference committee. So the license plate reader, in a short description, is something that attaches to your car or in a fixed location and reads a lot of license plates and refers them to a database, and we'll talk more about that, but I'm going to have the chief here explain the bill, because there's been certain members here that haven't seen or heard of this before. So we'll run through the bill and then take some questions. Thank you very much.
Gonna hang on.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, we have Mr. Gehring go through the DE7 amendment, basically the bill.
Mr. Gehring, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Matt Gehring from House Research. I staff civil law and data practices issues. So what I'm going to do is walk through the basic substance of what's in front of you in the form of the DE7 amendment. So starting on page 1, section 1 requires that law enforcement agencies disclose publicly whether an automated license plate reader was used when the when the agency engages in an arrest of a person. Page 2, section 2 requires that law enforcement agencies maintain a public record of the existence of all technology maintained by that agency that may be used to electronically capture an audio, video, photographic, or other record of the activities of the general public. This is public data at all times, so there are some circumstances under which the use of the technology might be protected data, but the existence of the technology within an agency must be public and disclosed to on data practices requests at all times. This section 2 is a modification of what previously was in the bill, which required an inventory of the surveillance technology by law enforcement agencies and a report to the legislature. So that section has been removed and replaced with this public data classification. Section 3, starting on page 2, is the real sort of substance of the automated license plate reader provision of the bill. Subdivision 1 contains the definition of readers. Subdivision 2 is a data classification. This subdivision limits the types of data that may be collected by an automated license plate reader to only license plate numbers, the date, time, and location data on vehicles that it captures, and then pictures of license plates, vehicles, and areas surrounding the vehicles. And this subdivision prohibits the collection of any other data other than what's listed here in the bill. Data that's collected by a license plate reader is automatically classified in this bill as private data and individuals, unless the data are either required to be public under a different section of statute or if the data are active criminal investigative data, which would carry a stricter classification. Paragraph C, starting on line 2.29, requires agencies to only use the Minnesota license plate data file for purposes of matching license plates that they collect through a license plate reader, although there is an exception that allows agencies to use additional sources of data for matching if that additional data that they're using is related to an active criminal investigation. And then this paragraph also prohibits creation of a central state repository of ALPR data. Starting at the top of page 3, this paragraph D prohibits the use of a license plate reader to target and track an individual person subject to an active investigation unless there's a warrant issued upon probable cause for that use. Subdivision 3, starting on line 3.4 of the amendment, is the basic retention schedule for data that is not active criminal investigative data. The default destruction period is 30 days from the time of collection if the data is what is commonly referred to as non-hit data. So if the license plate reader collects data that the agency is not using to pursue an investigation, it must be destroyed within 30 days. There's an exception for maintaining this data longer if the agency receives a written request from an individual who is the subject of a pending criminal charge or complaint. If they would like to use the data as exculpatory evidence, then the data must be maintained. There's also an exception for participants in the Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program that permits them to request that the data be destroyed immediately rather than within the 30-day window. Data that are an inactive criminal investigation, data that are related to an inactive investigation, will be subject to the standard destruction period that's in the agency's retention schedule that they should already have adopted under other law. Subdivision 4 regulates sharing among law enforcement agencies. Data that's not related to an active criminal investigation may only be shared with another agency upon meeting standards for requesting access today that I'll talk about in a minute. Those standards are provided in Subdivision 7 of the bill. And agencies that receive license plate reader data from a different agency must comply with all the data classification, destruction, and security requirements that are contained in the bill. Subdivision 5 requires agencies to maintain a log of use of license plate readers. The log has to include data on the specific times of data that the reader collected data, the aggregate number of vehicles or plates on which data are collected for each period of active use, and then certain types of data within specific categories that are collected by the reader, and then locations at which readers are posted, where they actually collect data, and where the readers are used. This log of use is required to be public. There is new language in this amendment that wasn't in the previous version of the bill that provides that if the agency determines that the location information of a fixed stationary license plate reader is security data, that determination is subject to judicial review in camera. Subdivision 6, starting on line 4.13, requires an annual audit. So in addition to the log of use that agencies must comply with, they are required to maintain records related to use of their readers and must arrange for an independent annual audit of the records to determine whether the agency is acting in compliance with the requirements of this section. The results of the audit are going to be public, and if a law enforcement agency is determined to be in a pattern of substantial noncompliance with the requirements of this section, they're required to immediately suspend operation of all of their license plate reader devices until the legislature has reauthorized their use. The order of suspension that would be triggered if there's a pattern of substantial noncompliance would be issued by the Commissioner of Administration. Subdivision 7 is a subdivision related to accessing the data. This is the sort of substantive provision that mentioned earlier about when individuals and agencies may request access to license plate reader data. There are existing cross-references on line 4.34 to statutes that govern how data must be maintained by a government entity and the security of that information. And so those cross-references are just, as I said, current practices under Chapter 13. Paragraph B, starting at the top of page 5, requires that agencies must establish a written policy to ensure that data is accessed only by those who are authorized in writing by the chief of police, sheriff, or head of the law enforcement agency to obtain data collected for a specific or for a legitimate, specified, and documented law enforcement purpose. This language also requires that the authorization be done on a case-by-case basis. Requests for access to data must be pertinent to an active criminal investigation and include a factual basis for the request and then associated case numbers, complaints, or incidents that are the basis of the request. Paragraph C, starting in line 5.10, requires what is essentially an audit trail. This is similar to language that exists for the MNsure database procedures so that agencies are required to track the individuals within their agency that are accessing the data and for what purpose, and to ensure that employees of the agency are sufficiently trained in the laws governing access to the data and in how to access the data itself. And then on line 5.5 or 5.15, there's a language that provides that this audit trail that would list the individuals within the agency that have accessed the data must be public. Subdivision 8, starting on line 5.17, requires notice to the BCA within 10 days of installation or use of license plate reader. And then the BCA is required to maintain a list of agencies that use readers, including locations of fixed stationary license plate readers. This list maintained by the BCA is public information. And again, as I mentioned earlier, if the agency determines that the locations of a fixed reader is security information, that determination is subject to judicial review. There's an effective date of August 1st. This is an effective date that's pushed back slightly from an earlier version of the bill, which had an immediate effective date. And then finally, Section 4, starting in 5.31, requires agencies to maintain and enforce a written policy governing use of license plate readers, and that use of license plate readers without adoption of a written policy is prohibited. And there are conditions or there are specific items that must be included in the agency's policy. And, Mr. Chair, that's the bulk of the details.
Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair, members, before we take questions, could I have the next testifier testify? The reason is because we realize the bill isn't perfect and we haven't satisfied everybody, but I'd just like to give you an idea of the changes that we've made since we've started, to give you an idea how hard we've worked on it to come to this far, and then if we could take questions after that. Also, I've been asked by one of the, I don't know if you call it opposition, but the data privacy people that we say that we're, when we would look at these amendments, it's not that we're against them and think they're bad amendments, it's if it's already covered or not needed. And I just wanted to say that. And if I could have the next testifier. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Please state your name and for the record.
Sure, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Potts. I'm the police chief for the city of Bloomington. And just to kind of highlight where we have come in the last month or so with regard to LPR, what before you today in the DE7 has really been, I think, a lot of good progress, conversation with law enforcement, with the chairs of the various committees, with the privacy folks. Minkoji was represented last week in a long, in fairly detailed conversation about what was going to be in DE7 today. The balance here is trying to balance privacy with our obligation in terms of providing safety. And we believe, law enforcement has kind of been making this comment for a long time, that LPR is a very good tool in helping keep our community safe. LPR has been useful in a number of cases that have already been probably discussed before you. The real issue has been trying to put in place enough guardrails, as it's been referred to provide some comfort for the collection of the data. And in this bill, in this amendment, DE7, I've counted about 9 or 10 new guardrails that will protect the data. They include restrictions on access. Those, as you've just heard, fairly clear and specific restrictions on who can access the data, what they have to have in order to access the data, requirement of independent annual audits is in this amendment. Retention of the data in this particular bill limited to 30 days. That differs from the Senate bill in that that one is a little longer at 90. Acquiring the use of the LPR system or use of LPR system in an investigation is public data now. Controls on how we share data with other law enforcement. It's tightly controlled in this in that you will have to have the agency requesting the data will need the same information as the agency that collects the data, a specific legitimate law enforcement purpose. Logs, as were mentioned, that log the use of this, the LPR systems. I've already mentioned the requirement for the independent audit. Requires policies, training, and in the policy it should include, it shall include specific language on discipline, something that was not a part of anything in the past. Notice to the BCA if you use LPR within 10 days. And those are, I think, you know, some of the guardrails that we've had discussions. Certainly there are some that I think we hope to have more conversation on. There are substantial noncompliance and a couple of other things. I think we just want to have some more conversation to really sort out what that means. But I think in terms of the bill that's before you today is really the product of a lot of discussion, negotiation between the various groups, and we're trying to continue with this to come up with something that ultimately I think works for everybody that's involved.
Chief Potts, I want to thank you for all you've done. This has not just been going on this year. For those of you who don't know, I also sit on the Civil Law Committee, so I've heard this bill rather extensively. But not just this year. Last session we dealt with this for most of the entire session, working it with it. So, does any members have any questions? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chief Potts, thank you for being here today. You gave Bloomington legislators a chance to ride along in a vehicle that had license plate readers. And I was really impressed with the way that your department handles the data. And just want to know, in your opinion, this 30 days, because I know we had a case in our district that somebody's apprehended after 64 days, I believe. And are you comfortable with the way it is now, or are there some parts of the bill we think can be better? And the second question has to do with the fixed readers, the fixed license plate readers. We have the Mall of America. And I guess my concern is, or do you have concerns about how that would play out in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal, with regard to the first question, with retention in how long law enforcement can retain the data, honestly, I do think 30 days is too short. We have cases in Bloomington that were solved after 64 days. The position we brought forward at the beginning of this session was 180 days, but we are working hard to strike a balance in terms of the length of time that we keep the data. I know there's value in keeping the data longer than 30 days. I am uncomfortable with that. We are trying to reach a point where there's some agreement and that everybody can live with the length of retention. The Senate bill is at 90 days, as you probably know. So, yes, 30 days is a concern in terms of how many cases we might not be able to solve because of that retention period. But I understand the concerns from the privacy folks, and so we are trying to work hard to find a balance there. With regard to the fixed locations, as this bill is written today, I don't have problems with that in terms of disclosing the locations of fixed locations. It's no secret to anybody that we've got the LPR fixed units at Mall of America. And so as the bill is written here today, I don't have a problem with the language regarding fixed.
Representative Pilsgrim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that was going to actually be one of my questions with regard to the fixed. So it says that an agency can go to court and get it declared security information in camera review. And where those readers are have to be reported to the BCA. I just want to make sure that that designation by the court actually follows from the local jurisdiction to the BCA in the event the court actually does declare it security information. And Mr. Chair, and if the language isn't perfect yet, Representative Cornish, we just want to make sure. Once somebody goes to court, we want to make sure that whatever the court orders follows the data no matter who's in possession of it. That would be the best. And then one last question that I have is When you have to disclose the information about where those stationary readers are, how much detail do you have to disclose, right? If I just say it's at the Mall of America, is that enough? Or do I have to say it's on the corner of the parking lot as you enter the ramp to the south third floor, whatever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it was our understanding that in terms of the Mall of America, for example, we cite the address of the Mall of America, which is 8124th Avenue, keeping in mind that those units can be moved fairly easily, and to try to cite specific locations, we've went with the address at the location that they are installed for Mall of America.
All right. Thank you.
Chief Schnell.
Mr. Chair, I can also just address that issue of the security declaration. It's our understanding then that typically the security declaration would be made by the law enforcement agency, and that the in-camera review would be something that that could be requested if somebody wanted to find out about that. A court would have to make that determination in camera as to whether or not that information should be, in fact, security.
And any other questions?
I think Mr. Neumeister has requested to testify too.
Mr. Neumeister.
Chairman, how are you? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. I just want to give a general comments about the presentation that was done. License plate readers collect millions and millions of scans of innocent, law-abiding Minnesota. Give you some of the examples. At the Mall of America, with their cameras, they collected 2.275 million records. It was a picture of your car, maybe you in the car, the license plate, the specific longitude and latitude, and the time. Again, depending on the camera, but that's what most of these cameras collect. 0.5% of 1%. 12,216 were hits. And that's the general premise of the bill that's fighting. Are we going to collect in a mass surveillance tool, as many, like Minneapolis has 30, 40 of these, St. Paul has a few, a small town with just one or two, as Mr. Chairman, as you said in civil law, you, on your ride along, you made a comment about how that LPR can collect a lot of information on innocent people, their comings and goings. So this is not no small matter. It deals with our privacy and liberty and the ability of government to be able to access all kinds of information and then to share it massively to other people. And there have been lots of articles about that. The other point that I wanted to share with you, that I personally oppose having information on innocent people in this mass surveillance tool. But then, as in somehow, some way, even being a long-term fixture here at the legislature, I'm also very much aware that compromise is part of the resolve. And so the efforts that I persistently try to do with this bill is that if you're going to collect information on innocent and law-abiding Minnesotans, you need the toughest protection. And I don't believe that we are there yet. So that will be some of the debate in terms of the retention. It's all over the board. The governor of Virginia right now maybe even signed it into law. It's 7 days. Our own state patrol has 48 hours. Across the legislative bodies, they're all dealing with all kinds of what the retention schedule is. The more and longer you keep the data, the more and kinds of mischief that can be. So, Mr. Chairman, it wasn't my to get in the details of the DE-7. It was more just to react a little bit to what the general presentation was, that at least, you know, this is no small pie in the plate, the way you just give it off. It's a big issue, and it will continue to be an issue because of the principles that we all believe in.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to one of the chiefs, I think one of you might be able to answer my question better. On the collection of the private data,
that was just mentioned. Can you make some kind of a comment about how that information collected on me, as I drive to the airport or the Mall of America or whatever, protects me? How can that be used to protect me?
Chief, no.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, without a doubt, I think we are collecting a tremendous amount of scans of license plates, but we have to remember that those scans are being checked against a list of actual kind of data that's provided by the BCA that includes warrants, people who are wanted. It may include people who are who do not have a driver's license. It may include people who are engaged in criminal activity such as abduction. It could include a vehicle that is involved in an Amber Alert situation. So while there is a tremendous amount of data that is collected by these devices, without a doubt, that the collection of that data allows us to later go back and check and determine, access it, to see if that can help us move forward the safety of all Minnesotans.
Representative Schoen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Cornish. Maybe this is a good spot to remind the members. Under current law, our law enforcement agencies or anybody that has an LPR prevented from keeping data for 3-4 years? Or are they mandated to get rid of it at any point in time right now?
Mr. Chair, President, no. Under the data classification, there is the temporary classification, but there is not significant limitations on it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, so what happens if we don't pass this law? What happens to the concerns of folks about that are raising concerns about the data storage? Because that's where we're at, is the data storage and data access. What happens to it if we do nothing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, then I think about the only thing you would retain would be a temporary data classification until that runs out. But otherwise, you lose your audits. You lose your the list, the inventory, the methods of surveillance that they use, that they have to report, the reporting to the BCA, the agreement on the time limit. The time limit would be endless of retention. So you would lose all the protections that are currently in the bill and gain very little.
Mr. Chair and Chair Cornish, did you come up with this proposal by yourself all on your lonesome in your office, and this is Tony's way, and so this is the way we're going to do it? Is that how you – did you arrive at this way, or did you come together with a coalition of folks and say, this is the best we could do to try to make as many people happy as we could so we could get this thing together and actually make legislation happen this year?
Actually, I had not little to do with it, but I had not as much nearly as the work that the data privacy people, that the chief, law enforcement, different contributors, I was basically just a facilitator, and they came to me with the idea, and it was a collaboration of a large working group that put it all together, and quite successfully, I think, from where we started, there was quite contentious, and it turned out to be a pretty good deal for both parties, I think, in the DE7.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think I'm going to echo what Chair Cornish said off the get-go, that this bill needs to leave this committee in the shape that it sits before us presently. And I would encourage the authors of any future amendments to think about the work that's gone into this, and that it may not be perfectly great for you, because it's not perfectly great for me as I see it. You know, I think of a lot of circumstances, and today I'm wearing a pin memorializing Officer Tommy Decker up in Cold Spring, and we still don't know for sure who murdered him while he was protecting the citizens of Cold Spring. But maybe somebody might have seen something that said, well, this vehicle, or we could have said, yeah, you're right, the guy that that we found who committed suicide in his shed that owned that gun. You're right, that what he was in town that night. Maybe. But we don't know for sure. And it's about controlling the access, and that's what you're trying to do, and to make sure that the citizens' information are protected, to make sure that we don't create a society where we're constantly surveilled under how people feel that or believe that that's happening. And this is going to create limitations on the time that that we can keep the data. I think it's fair. I'm not happy with 30 days by a long shot. And but I will say this, if any of these amendments go on the bill, then I would advocate voting against the bill and then coming back together, or maybe even just pulling the bill today, Representative Cornish, and say, you know what, we worked on it, but if it's going to be where you don't want it, if you don't want license plate readers and you don't want this technology, and the same thing's going to come up when it comes to body cameras, if you don't like them, introduce the bill that says you can't have them. Because it'll be a lot cheaper on our government agencies, our local governments, to say, you know what, don't buy them, because we don't want you to have them. So we're trying to deal with a very, very tenuous situation here amongst people and feelings about collection and maintenance of data. And I understand that. But we also have to take public safety into account, and I think you've done a really good job at working to a solution that we can get closer to agreeing on. And thank you, Chief Snell and Chief Potts, for your work on this, too.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cornish, this is not, obviously, the Civil Law Committee. But it's my understanding that, based on news accounts that I've read, that there is a significant private industry for license plate readers, and that there is a national database compiled by car repo companies that has something like almost 2.5 billion records compiled, and every vehicle in the United States appears in that database at least 9 times. And so my question is, are we applying this same standard about license plate readers to private sector data collectors that we're applying to public safety officials, or are we creating an extra restrictive standard on public safety that we're not applying to the private sector?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I think this bill just applies to law enforcement, but you're correct. There's all sorts of data being collected on everything nationwide. I can't remember what that was. It UPS or somebody was just, or Postal Service even, the federal government. They found a license plate reader out in front of one of their doors here the other day, and they were trying to distance themselves from it. So, yeah, it's going on all over. At least with law enforcement, we're going to have some controls that currently aren't on the private sector.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I'm glad that you're working on this issue and that people are trying to find a compromise. It just seems to me that the urgency to restrict the use of data by people who are charged with keeping us safe is maybe a little bit misguided if we're not pursuing an equal measure of protection against private sector companies who can indiscriminately collect this data and, so far as I know, use it for whatever commercial purpose they would like. I don't understand how our privacy is protected if public safety officials can't hold on to it for crime prevention purposes, but it can be used for other commercial purposes. And so it's a good thing to move forward, but I hope that law enforcement doesn't feel the need to compromise too much in a data collection world that is far more encompassing than the data that they use, with far fewer restrictions on the constitutional limits on the ways in which they can use that data and the purposes for which they can use that data. And I just hope we're not tipping this balance too far one direction when we're doing little or nothing that I'm aware of to stop the widespread collection of private data on all of us that can be used for any purpose whatsoever.
Representative Newberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Cornish, would you just refresh me and the rest of the committee? Is this bill intended to be included in the omnibus bill, or are you intending to move this to the floor straight to the general register?
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, it's our intention to move this alone to the floor.
Okay, next we have Representative Constantine, but members after Representative Constantine, I'd like to get to the amendments. We have 10 of them to go through before, and one more bill yet. Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on what Representative Winkler was saying, I am much more supportive of law enforcement having that than I have the people in the private sector. At some point, not today, I'm not offering an amendment, but I guess I'd like to know what it would take to enact these same restrictions or more on the private people that are collecting data on me. Thank you.
Okay, members, we have a number of amendments. The first one is A5.
Mr. Chair, actually, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to move the A12 amendment.
Go ahead with your A12 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And by way of background, I just want to lay a foundation here. So a little bit about my background. I started out, I have a great respect for law enforcement and the industry and the profession and what they do. I consider myself a piece or part of law enforcement. When I was going to school for law enforcement, my background is a bachelor's in law enforcement. I've been through skills, and I am post-license eligible, and I've kept my post-license eligibility up all these years, and to date I still am. But it was when I was in school, I decided to take my desire for law enforcement and the enforcing of standards, etc., to keep people safe into a different direction. And I took it in the direction of computer security. So for the last 10 years, that's what I do for a living is digital security, information security. So that's a little bit about where I'm coming from. Regarding the climate of the modern day, if you remember back in the late 90s, I think it was, people began to become sensitive to private information. And it first manifested itself with a regulation, HIPAA. Among the first of the modern day of putting some controls around protecting what's considered private information or sensitive information. You know, as years go on, there's been instances such as Enron and Arthur Andersen, which brought in the era of Sarbanes-Oxley, and it was additional controls around information and ensuring the accuracy of information, et cetera. And we go on, high-tech, so HIPAA and high-tech related to governing healthcare or health-related information. Gramm-Leach-Bliley related to the controls and governing financial institutions. Sarbanes-Oxley, any U.S.-based publicly traded company falls in that. And then there's another one that's slightly different than the ones I just mentioned, and that is PCI, payment card industry. That relates to any merchants or any organizations that are processing, transmitting, or storing credit card information. And what makes that different than the first I mentioned were, the first are regulatory compliance mandates from government. So government saying, here are private industry, here are some controls and regulations that you must abide by if you so choose to have and control or house private information. Whereas PCI was an industry grown, right? It was industry, the payment card industry in itself, not waiting for government to say, there are controls on you. It's they, among themselves, worked out the controls and said, it's self-imposed. If anybody is going to engage in credit card transactions, merchants now, these are the controls they must abide by. And the difference being, let me mention one more thing then. In addition to the climate, we have, and this is on people's radars, private information being kept private and the controls around them being sufficiently rigorous. We have, locally here, Target breaches, Super Value breaches of private data, Dairy Queen, not local, Home Depot, and the headlines go on. So this is on people's radars in terms of keeping information private. The difference between the regulatory compliance versus the breaches, regulatory compliance mandates are proactive. It's trying to protect the data before something happens, whereas the breaches are in response to something that's now happened. And so with that background, with the 812, what I'm specifically doing here, some comments have been made that there are sufficiently rigorous safeguards in place and the protections are good enough. That, in my opinion, is simply not true. This is not meant to be controversial, the 812, but it addresses the technical controls and trying to make them a little bit stronger because they are absent. So, for example, line 1.4, that's addressing remote access. It's very common in the industry. By the way, the amendments, what I've done here is the pages are hundreds. It's hundreds of pages, those regulations that are imposed and or self-imposed on industry of the controls around technology systems. Right, this is just a few of very big, I mean, it would be just the tip of the iceberg of what some of those controls would be. So I took the hundreds of pages and summarized it to just some basic stuff. Then I took this and summarized it to just a few lines. And so the first four amendments here that I'm going to offer are taking those the best I can and categorize them into topical areas. So it's taking the similar controls and putting them into the same amendment. So on the 812, 1.4 and 1.5 has to deal with remote access. So when it comes to data and the storage of sensitive data, controlling where it can be accessed from. So if this laptop, for example, represented the sensitive data and the technology system that's being stored on the server, for example, and this represented the laptop that's going to be accessing that data, this can't be up on the internet. You can't come from your laptop, from the internet, and access the data. That's what that line is getting at there. Versus what is the common practice or industry standard best practice is to access the data not directly from the internet, but from another source. You put this in a, either it's on the network or another location for the source. The next lines, 1.6 and 7, have to deal with the unique username. There was speak about in the DE Amendment 7, if you look at that, Subdivision 7, specifically Section C, that refers to access and controlling access. There is not enough language in there to specify how to control access. So here it's just saying you must have a unique username. So anybody who's going to access the systems has to have a username, and it has to be unique. It can't be the same username that's shared by four people. One username for one person. That's what the next line is, line 1.8, no sharing of usernames. You simply can't take a username that you're going to use to access the system and share it with other people. It's very basic security controls here, which, again, are absent from the discussions or from the DE7. Line 1.8 and 9, no sharing of passwords. So a person who has been assigned a username and password to have legitimate access to the system that controls the data, they can't share their password around. Very basic industry best practice, just don't share your password around. You have to keep it to yourself. Line 1.10, you cannot use the username and password of another. So if you're going to log in to access the data, if you have somebody else's username and password, you can't log in as them. Because if you log in as them and access the data, now it's anything you do to that data, whether it's read it, change it, delete it, it's going to appear that the person, a different person, did it. Again, very basic. Next line down, which is line 1.0, when it comes to servers and laptops, etc., they have what's called a root account or the administrator account. It's a built-in account that exists on all systems. And what this is saying, you cannot use the root account or the administrator account to log in to access the data. You have to use your username that was assigned to you. Because if you use the administrator account, again, it loses the audit trail. You won't know who logged in because it'll show the username of administrator. You see, that's what that's getting at there. The next lines down, line 13 and 14, are simply saying all paper and electronic media containing LPR data, including paper and electronic backups, simply must be stored in a secure location. So that's this line-by-line summary here, and it's, again, basic, not meant to be controversial, but these are items that are absent right now from DE7. Great.
I've been over here waving the whole time.
Representative Quam was first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
to one of the testifiers, my understanding is because in the recent history there was some controversy about some legislators and others who had dozens of pings on their license plate, that there were controls that were instigated that you're now utilizing. And my understanding is that some of those controls actually match the intent of only one user and having a log of access. Can you let us know existing similar type controls on, you know, the license plate database?
Chief Snow?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, right now people who would access any of the data systems would need to have their unique password, or it has to be through a secure VPN, where we can check, we can see who is using that device that accessed that system. And really, that is in many respects what the provision is. So there are mechanisms right now to be able to track who, either through the device or through a specific username and password that goes along with that. And many of those requirements are established by the BCA and required as part of our agreements around this criminal justice data network.
Thank you.
Chief Schnell, along with that, in your policy, can anybody have access to the data, or is it limited to a certain few to be able to access to that data?
Mr. Chair, as it is established at my agency, and I know this is also the case in Chief Potts, there is only a limited number of people. Those people do have, exactly as was indicated, an individual user password and username, and that is all tracked in the system.
Thank you. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, did you talk to the BCA or Minute prior to drafting this amendment?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have had conversations with them in the past, and I'm familiar based on my experience with some of the controls and what's being referred to here, but I did not talk to them specifically regarding the drafting of this particular language.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, here's the way I read it, and I have obviously maybe shared a different opinion, and I'm just going to say why I don't think the amendment's necessary. I'm not saying that your intent is wrong, just to be clear. Because right now, any computer that would be connected to an NCIC database, which that would to store that data, because it's got to be, you got to marry the database from the license plate reader to get to the hot files to NCIC hits at some point, so they're going to be connected. And so that is directly already controlled under regulations and procedures that we have to follow, whether you're the state patrol, whether you're a police department, sheriff's department, DNR conservation officer, whether it's in the squad car or otherwise, that is controlled through the BCA. And so what I'd be concerned about is that your amendment shifts what's already in place to have those security measures in place, which actually I'm not even sure. I think some of it comes down through federal law as well, too. But I don't want to say that's 100% sure, but I believe that's accurate. So secondly, when you talk about that you can't have access through the Internet, one of the things that's concerning to me is that basically that statement right there shuts down LPRs altogether, and here's why. In my squad car, when I'm driving around, it's connected through Verizon, a secure connection, through the BCA, through all the correct and secure data ports for me to see that and to get the data out to my squad, to push out the files, to push them back. And so that would basically shut down the use of an MDT, so I wouldn't even be able to see if a person is wanted, if their car is stolen or otherwise. So that's very concerning with the way your amendment is drafted. Being concerned about the administrator, I would assume that you know this, is that I can assign Chief Schnell as an administrator under his own username. And I think sometimes it's like you log in as administrator, and then it's just because, you know, it's one person at the agency that handles IT or something, and they say, well, I'm just going to type in as administrator. So I don't know that that's necessary, because I think you could just say you've got to use your own username. But I think your amendment's unnecessary simply because we're not addressing it in the statute because it's already addressed in other areas how we handle our information sharing from the BCA when it's even connected to NCIC just alone. I think it's a bad idea.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment on that would be, we understand that agency policy is different than statutory law. And that's exactly right. There is policy at the BCA regarding some of these controls, those were referenced. But that is different what I'm trying to do, and there shouldn't be a dispute then. If we're taking those policies that are already in place and we're simply raising them up now, the requirements, you have to use your username. You can't use somebody else's password. Good policy, but now we're raising them to a requirement.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Lucero, again, I mean, just alone, you're basically shutting down the use of a mobile data computer with your amendment.
Mr. Chair, regarding that point, no, I'm not, and that's because what was referenced, VPN technology now stretches the network to a remote location. Now it goes across the Internet, but that's different than a laptop on the Internet not connected to the VPN accessing the data. So that's why it doesn't apply to what you're referencing.
Representative Strong, I do have one question for you. Do you have room in your squad car for another computer for this program? I've been in the squad car. The answer is
you never have a partner.
The answer is pretty much no. There's no room, hardly room for any more equipment in a squad car. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, I'm opposed to your amendment, and the first sentence of your amendment and the last sentence of your amendment are the reason. First, direct access from the Internet, as Representative Schoen said, to any system component in an automated license plate reader data environment is prohibited. So they get the data through the Internet. They hook their laptop up through the Internet, so any component would mean they cannot use it unless they collect the data and then take that information and go to the location of where the data is physically connected, and then they would find out, well, they're long since past the vehicles that they're looking at to find out whether or not it was hit or not. Second, all paper electronics media containing automatic license plate reader data, including paper and electronic backups, must be stored in a physically secure location. So all information related to license plate readers must be in a secure location. I can't imagine that a squad car would meet that definition, and they're collecting the data mostly in squad cars. So I don't know how that could meet the definition. This amendment really would, in my opinion, shut down the use of license plate readers in the state.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. To the last point there, the last line, I should say, I think most would say that a squad car is considered a safe location. But again, that's open to interpretation. To the first point, it wouldn't shut it down because, as I said, VPN technology exists. Now, I can work from home. I can take my laptop, work from home, understand the difference between utilizing the Internet to access the network versus being on the Internet to access your network. It's very different. My laptop, this is my laptop, and I was working from home. I'm using VPN technology, a secured encrypted tunnel, through the Internet to access remotely the corporate network to be able to access secure data. So that's what this is addressing. And there's a big difference between the two. And so it would not shut down the system, this amendment.
Representative Palm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I speak both the tech and some of them understand some of the common interpretations. What I think is that there are some really good, and I've read through the amendments, really good content and details. I think there's some existing systems. And depending on the path of this bill, I think would be nice if we could get the parties together and look at some of these concerns. And I think that you've got processes in place and maybe look at addressing it there. I think what's becoming obvious is that a good portion of the committee is not maybe as versed in the technical aspects, and that, that's just my suggestion is there's good stuff here. There might be some compatibility. I think a discussion and possible, amendment in the process as this bill moves along would be maybe a really good process as opposed to trying to, all 10 of these amendments.
Mr. Chair, I'll just make one comment. And these comments will not be for all the amendments, so just getting them all out here in the first one. And that is, I agree with you, but unfortunately it's going to the General Register. So this is the last opportunity for those, except for amendments on the floor, which are even more one step removed from doing the amendments in committee. The comment I would make is doing things retroactively when it's well known in any industry, whether building a home, whether technology systems, when you're implementing the new system, with the exception of a few that are in place now, I don't know, Minneapolis, Bloomington, a few who are using them now, but for the most part, addressing new systems that would be as a result of this, when you implement a new infrastructure, it's always easiest to implement the controls at the same time you're implementing the new infrastructure. The analogy I would use is anybody who's done remodeling, it's always easier to do the plumbing or the wiring in an unfinished basement while it's being constructed than it is to come after the fact and try to implement something new plumbing, new wiring, in an existing system in a finished basement. So that's the difference here. It's good to get these controls in place while new infrastructures are being stood up versus coming back and trying to do it retroactively. It creates a significant number of challenges to do it after the fact.
Anybody else wish to speak on this amendment?
I think for brevity, as each of these amendments are offered, the author's response would be just that we oppose amendment would ask for a vote. So that's what I would do now.
All those in favor of this amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is not adopted.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I would move the A13.
Go ahead with the A13.
For the sake of brevity, I'll try and be much quicker. The A13 amendment has the topical category of audit. So it is addressed in, line 2.26 of the DE5 amendment classifies ALPR data as private, right? So we're in agreement that it's considered private data. It should be considered sensitive. Subdivision 6A, line 4.16 through 4.19, requires an annual audit, which is a good thing, to verify compliance with subdivision 7, which is authorization to access the data. But when looking at the requirements there of what needs to be protected within the audit logs, it's lacking. It references section 13.05, subdivision 5. It references 13.055. There's nothing that details the information to be retained. Right, so we all agree that information is private, the DE7 amendment classifies the data as private. The sections reference that an annual audit should occur, but there isn't anything that details what's going to be audited, or how do you audit information if it doesn't exist? So that's what this one tries to get to. And it simply says, if you look at lines 1.4 through 1.11 of the A13 amendment, the within each audit log, you have to have the type of event that it is. You have to have the username, the date, time it occurred, whether it was a failed or a success, the origin, so the origin of the system where the access, for example, came from, and then what was done to the data. Was it deleted, read only, modified, etc.? So in order to actually have an audit, you have to have information that contains sufficient detail to audit. Right, you can't have an audit if the date timestamps are missing, for example, or the usernames are missing. Right, and it the detail is to that effect. So I'll just summarize with that. So it just gets to what data should be retained and protected in order to have an audit that occurs on an annual basis. Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish.
The author would oppose that amendment and ask for a no vote.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion failed.
Mr. Chair, I'll offer the A11 amendment. And real quickly, this amendment has two sections. The first one says that when it comes to the storage, or when it comes to the LPR data, third-party or hosted networks are prohibited. It must be used, systems that are within the control of law enforcement agency must be used. And the topical category I would summarize this would be a separate environment. You don't want to commingle the data. So you can't have the data where the LPR license plate data that's being stored is. You don't want to commingle that on the same server that's a web server or any other kind of information, right? It's very common within the industry, within security best practice, to have separate environments. That's what this one tries to do, just have a dedicated environment so to prevent data from being commingled.
Representative Cornish?
The author would oppose the amendment and ask for a no vote.
All those in favor of this amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion amendment did not pass.
Mr. Chair, I will offer the A14 amendment.
Go ahead with your A14 amendment.
And this amendment gets to security protection measures. That's how I would label this one. And so lines 1.4 through 1.8, it simply says that that data, which is, or those systems which are going to be containing sensitive data, the data that's been considered private, in order to protect those servers, et cetera, they have to have a host-based firewall. They have to have an antivirus software installed on it. You have to have an intrusion prevention system installed on it and file integrity monitoring installed on it. And again, these are very basic controls that the industry uses to protect systems. Because a system cannot, while the data is classified as private, it can't be protected if you don't have antivirus software installed on it. The last line says, lines 1.8 and 9 say, automated license plate reader data must be encrypted. So where it's stored, you just have to encrypt it. Because when it comes to data breaches, et cetera, we want to ensure that data is not readable if it's if the system is compromised. If a server becomes compromised and the data on it's encrypted, the data still can't be read. So that's what this tries to get at.
Representative Cornish?
The author would oppose the amendment. Ask for a no vote, please.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
All right. Then I will move the... Mr. Chair, let's move to the A5 amendment. This one simply says that those local municipalities who are going to choose to engage in LPR data collection simply have to have a public hearing. So if local municipality, the law enforcement agency of that municipality says that they want to engage in this, they petition the council to approve the funding and the use of the technology, the council or other agency would just simply have to hold a public hearing to allow public comment.
Author would oppose the amendment and ask for a no vote.
Motion failed.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A6 amendment. This is the no chilling effect. And this is simply, there is a concern regarding the right to assemble, right, peacefully assemble, et cetera. So when somebody is engaged in other constitutional rights, there is a concern that people may be dissuaded from engaging those. When they group together, they may all be parked in a parking lot, or they come together for one rally or another, right, a pro-tax increase rally or a tax cut rally, whatever it is. And this simply says that those civil liberties engaging in those will be protected so that this technology hopefully will not persuade law-abiding citizens from engaging in those activities.
Author would oppose the amendment and ask for a no vote.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I think there might be some people who want to testify to this.
like Mr. Olson wishes to testify on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor emeritus from Hamline University Law School. I'm speaking here today as a private citizen, not on behalf of the university. This provision doesn't prevent anything. What it does is it recognizes that if, for example, in this time of year, there are 12 or 14 gun shows that go on in the metropolitan area. And if you took your license plate reader and parked it at each one of them, you would know who went. You would have a list of probably all of the gun owners in the metropolitan area. And if people knew about that, they wouldn't go to these constitutionally protected activities where they can engage in free speech, where they can organize, where they can assemble, where they can exercise their constitutional rights to buy and sell protected items. And that would have a very chilling effect on attendance once people found out. This says if you're going to do this, it says you can do it. If you're going to do this, you have to have reasonable efforts to limit the scope of the activities to an active criminal investigation. And the head of the agency has to be the one who signs off on this particular kind of surveillance. Nothing is prohibited. We're asking for them to stop and think about protecting the rights of those 100,000 or so completely innocent Minnesotans. And if there is an active criminal investigation, go ahead and do it. Just limit the scope as much as you can. And we think this is important enough that it should be signed off by the commander of the agency. Now, this amendment does not in any way prevent the operation of license plate readers.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm an NRA life member. If there was anything in here that would affect gun shows adversely, I would probably would be worried about it. But sometimes gun shows are combined with gun shows, knife shows, gun shows, relic shows, gun shows, and schools, gun shows. I mean, you won't be able to tell what kind of a gun show it is. Sometimes there's guns shown in there, and it's not labeled as a gun show. And so I think the amendment is unworkable and unneeded and would oppose it.
If I may say one additional thing, the amendment is not limited to gun shows. And I once read a book about the New York Police Department's Red Squad that spent all of its time in the 60s and 70s chasing after liberal groups, people who probably vote Democratic. Now they've switched their sights. They're going after more conservative groups. The interesting thing is that very little law enforcement activity ultimately resulted. Lots of people's pictures were taken. Lots of people's names were written down. Great many lists were made. And very few crimes were prevented or solved. So when we're interfering with all kinds of constitutionally protected activity, I think the police should be careful. And that's what this amendment asked for.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, the problem is that we don't know what's going on. There could be 1,000 cars parked there, but you don't have a sign up. You're putting the departments in liability position when we have a license plate reader, either stationary or mobile, out in front of those places. We don't know what's gone on. Then afterwards, we hear it was a gun show or a civil rights group. We don't know that, and could be guilty just by association of being there. Plus, the Mall of America has had these things up, and people know about it for years, and it hasn't stopped the attendance there. So I just think the amendment is unworkable.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when I look at this, I become a little bit concerned because we're talking about out in the public. And ultimately, out in the public, when I'm out there, I mean, any citizen can photograph my car, can photograph me. and those types of things. So I'm curious that this is putting more restrictions, again, on law enforcement than we do on, you know, public citizens and private citizens that are able to do the same thing. So I would support the chair in opposing this amendment.
Mr. Chair, just a parliamentary procedure question here. Representative Hillstrom, on the bill that we have up for tomorrow, the necessity defense, do you feel that it's going to take very long, or could we add that to our agenda and stick around a little bit till we get this one to preserve coming back at night? Would you folks be up for that, or would you think that is going to run us along if we add it tomorrow?
Mr. Chair and Representative,
I mean, we can come back live if you'd like, but
Representative Cornish, I actually had spoke to your staff that if we could get through these amendments, I think the folks that really care about this issue are in the room, and it's always helpful to kind of power through and finish while people are here and they have the opportunity to hear the debate. And so I have no objection to you adding that bill to the agenda for tomorrow. Whether it takes 5 minutes tomorrow or 5 hours, we'll still be here tomorrow. So.
Okay. If I might respond, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, are we having a debate between the author and the testifier?
We do need to get going. I believe there is one more testifier on this amendment yet. Mr. Newmeyer decided not to. So, all those in favor of this amendment?
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No.
Just have a few more to go here.
Are we going to do them now? Okay, let's plow along real fast.
We're going to plow through them real quick.
I will move the A8 amendment, Mr. Chair. And this speaks about when there's a hit regarding license plate, that in and of itself does not constitute reasonable suspicion to pull somebody over. So that when an officer can certainly respond, that they have to have, they have to achieve the threshold of reasonable suspicion using an independent means once they're on location with them to pull them over.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going to be really short. What that would say is, if you get a hit, officer, that there's a warrant for that person, or that's the person that you're looking for in an abduction, you can't stop the car. That's what your amendment says. Vote no.
Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is basically policy, what some law enforcement agencies do follow. And all you're doing is putting that policy, which some law enforcement agencies do have and some don't, is you're having consistency among all the law enforcement agencies as they begin to get more LPRs as time progresses. Yes.
Representative Cornish.
Just respectfully request a no vote.
All those in favor of this amendment?
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. Amendment failed.
Mr. Chair, I will move the A9 amendment. And this one simply says that, as we're probably familiar with in Facebook, facial recognition technology exists today. And this amendment would simply prevent the use of facial recognition technology in conjunction with ALPR. So you can't put the two next to each other and then now begin to capture people's faces and store it.
Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, this committee was not available to listen to a lot of the fair testimony that was done in the civil law. A number of the folks who serve on this committee know facial recognition is coming to LPR, ALPR, with integration and all this. And rather than play catch-up, I think law enforcement buying these possible products without us knowing later out the gate, you as policymakers should be able to know about these things. Or Minnesota police chiefs and so folks are starting to buy this, that they come to the legislature and say, hey, we got facial recognition now. We're able to put it on ALPRs. We'd like to have your blessing rather than we find out about it a year or two down the line. So that's what basically amendment does, is gives you the policymakers control rather than the technology drive.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I think we're
some people are assuming automatically that facial recognition is bad. I don't think we've made that decision yet, and I would rather not put that into this bill and limit us either way, and maybe this could be taken up in a separate bill, but I'd rather not have it on this one. That's for a no vote.
Mr. Chair, members, we're pretty far over. I'm sure there'll be discussion after the amendments. I'm no fan of sticking around tonight, but a lot of us have obligations of where we're supposed to be. What, no one's going to discuss it after the amendment? Okay, good.
All those in favor of this amendment?
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion passed.
And, Mr. Chair, I am, for the sake of time, I'm not going to offer the A7 amendment right now. So the last one I'm going to offer is the A10 amendment. And this one simply allows for the reporting of data in terms of the use, et cetera, of ALPR data.
Representative Cornish. Mr. Old.
Mr. Chairman, Joseph Olson again. What this amendment does, the audit trail that we currently have tells you whether the system is operating. The addition of this information would tell you whether the system is operating and producing any useful results sufficient to overwhelm the privacy interests of the citizens. Now, I would think, looking at these four items, that a manager of a police agency that had LPRs would already be asking these questions. They would already have this information. They would obviously know how many. They would want to know how many matches. You know, we paid $10,000 for the thing. We've put it on the main intersection in town all year. And we have had four matches. I'm obviously exaggerating a bit. The number of matches that identified vehicles sought by law enforcement and resulted in stops. The number of matches that resulted in searches of vehicles and individuals, releases, arrests, or other outcomes. So I think it's important to know in reaching a rational decision whether LPRs are really useful, whether they're producing results. The audit trail doesn't tell you that. These four additional items would provide the information necessary to say, yes, okay, you caught 75 stolen cars, you caught 350 people with revoked licenses, and it's worth doing.
Mr. Olson, I understand what you're saying. But for a mother or a parent who lost their child in an abduction, just that one time, it is the most precious thing they did. It's the most important thing. Nothing happened to that child. It doesn't matter the number they get. Is that they're working and saving lives and possibly saving lives. Representative Cornish.
We had a large working group together with MnCOCHI. Is that the right acronym? We come to an agreement, and this wasn't part of it, and it's extraneous information I don't think is needed. I would ask for a no vote.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
Motion failed. Is there any other amendments? Any last comments?
Mr. Chair, members, I just want to make it clear I meant no disrespect to the author, whoever came up with these amendments, but with the time that I've seen them before and working all weekend with all the groups involved, and I sensed from the committee that they want this to end, and they felt fairly comfortable with the going out of the committee in this form, knowing that it's not perfect and there'll be more changes made. That's what was my wish for brevity, and I thank the author of the amendments and actually for being able to voice them here and raise an awareness, and we can work on things that we think need to be addressed in conference. And that would be it. If anybody's got any questions, otherwise, I would move House File 222 as amended to go to the General Register.
Mr. Chair, we'd ask for roll call.
Roll call has been requested.
Representative Cornish.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Considine.
Yes.
Representative Dean.
Aye.
Representative Hertas. Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Howe.
Aye.
Representative Lohmer.
Yes.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Neuberger.
Aye.
Representative O'Neill.
Yes.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Rosenthal.
Aye.
Representative Schoen.
Aye.
Representative Ward.
Yes.
Representative Winkler.
Aye.
Representative Zerwas.
The motion passes. The bill will move on to general register. For those of you...
Tomorrow on this one?
Do that one tomorrow.
Then we don't need to come back and then we put that onto the agenda for tomorrow?
That will work. Representative Cornish, I want to thank you for all the work you did on this. This is a almost three-year project going through this, so I want to thank all the groups that work with this. This meeting is adjourned.